The Senate Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee will come to order. Just for people in the audience that are tracking it, there has been one change. Senate File 744 will not be heard this afternoon. That will be moved to tonight's evening. So we'll be acting on Senate File 726, Pretner Solon, and Senate File 1168 during this time frame. And with that, Senator Pretner Solon, if you'd like to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I want to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to present Senate File 726 before the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection today. And I'm here with representatives from my district who have been diligently working on a community-based approach to increasing access to health care in the Duluth area. They are part of the Twin Ports Health Access Program, a program which implemented several initiatives to reduce the number of uninsured in the area. We are all well aware that there is a growing number of uninsured in our state. The most recent study by the Minnesota Department of Health indicates that the number of uninsured increased from 5.7% in 2001 to 7.4% in 2004, and I know that we have statistics that show that it's even higher at this time. The biggest change is the dramatic decrease in employer-based coverage. In 2001, 68% of businesses offered health insurance, and in 2004, that dropped to 62%, a 6% decrease. Of those 6% who lost employer-based health insurance, 4% enrolled in public programs, and nearly 2% moved into the ranks of the uninsured. Both of these trends are disturbing. This same report by the Minnesota Department of Health indicates that the vast majority of the uninsured work, and most work full-time. Those involved in the Twin Ports Access Program have studied this issue and have researched national models for increasing access for the uninsured. One model that has been successful in other parts of the country is the multiple share coverage model. This model actively engages business, local health care organizations, and the community in expanding health coverage. Multiple share programs focus on expanding health coverage to those working in small businesses, the people who are most likely to be uninsured. I had the opportunity to hear directly about the multiple share model from the director of a successful program that has operated for 7 years in Muskegon, Michigan, and I've also spoken with representatives from the statewide program operating in Oklahoma. I believe that this type of program has potential for here in Minnesota. Last year, the legislature approved a multiple share demonstration project in 4 counties of northeastern Minnesota. And during the past year, the Twin Ports Health Access Program has further developed the program and has a funding proposal to the legislature for just over $1 million. It's actually $1,050,000. This is a one-time request to provide partial funding for the 5-year project, and that is $200,000 per year for 5 years. The state contribution will be matched by a local foundation in Duluth, Generations Healthcare Initiatives, and also funding from other sources. And I'll now turn over testimony to Jenny Peterson of Generations Healthcare Initiatives, who will tell you more about the multiple share program that they call HealthShare.
Thank you, Pretner Solon. Let the record state there is a quorum present. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Pretner Solon. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Jenny Peterson, and I'm with Generations Healthcare Initiatives. We are a foundation located in Duluth, Minnesota, that focuses solely on health issues. Our number one priority is expanding health access to underserved populations. Just over 2 years ago, Generations embarked on a project we call the Twin Ports Health Access Program. The program looks to serve low-income, uninsured people in Duluth and the surrounding area. We formed a coalition with representatives from healthcare, county health and human services, not-for-profit agencies, a local health plan, businesses, and faith community. We knew a broad-based coalition was necessary to tackle this issue because when people lack access to healthcare, the whole community is impacted. The coalition has designed specific strategies to, one, reduce the number of uninsured, two, improve the continuity and quality of care for people who are underserved, and three, lower the cost of care for those who don't have coverage and also for organizations who provide uncompensated care. The Twin Ports Healthcare Access Program has developed and implemented several strategies to increase healthcare access. As Senator Pretner Solon said, we were surprised as we started the issue that most people in the area who are uninsured work. 75% of those who are uninsured work, and nearly most of those work full-time, over 31 hours a week. It is also noteworthy that most of the people who are uninsured work for small businesses. We saw this as an opportunity in our area. As we researched national models, we came across one that we thought was very appealing, and that is the multi-share health coverage program. This type of program is for small businesses that employ low-wage workers. There are two key features to this program. One is that there's a community fund that augments contributions from employers and employees. In other words, the community joins a fund, and there are multiple players that help support it. The second key feature is that this is a local coverage program that involves participating businesses and local health care organizations. The program focuses on primary care and prevention and tries to avoid crisis care that happens when people delay care. We have used the successful model in Muskegon County, Michigan, as the prototype for this program. In the Muskegon program, the cost of care is, as I said, shared. It costs about $160 a month. The employer pays about 30% or $50 a month. The employee pays 30% or $50 a month. And this community fund pays $60 or 40% of the cost. What is unique about this type of program is that the business is eligible, not the employee. It is not a social service program. There are not means tests. This is for small businesses who have low-wage workers. The business is eligible, one, if it employs fewer than 51 people, two, that it has not offered any kind of coverage within the past 12 months, and three, that the median wage is $12.50 an hour. This is 275% of the poverty level, or $26,000 a year. So we are talking about low-wage workers. The Muskegon program has over 1,100 people enrolled and 350 businesses participating. During the 7 years of operation, it has served well over 2,000 people. As was noted, last year the legislature passed a bill that allowed for a demonstration project for this type of program in northeastern Minnesota. The bill, however, did not include funding. We are requesting that the state of Minnesota become a funding partner in this program and provide an additional $1,050,000. $1 million will go towards that community fund I talked about. The other $50,000 will go for an evaluation. This is really a small investment of $200,000 per year for the full 5 years. So again, just a small investment that will be matched by local funds from the foundation that I work with, Generations Healthcare Initiatives, and also other foundations. We in Duluth see the creation of a multiple share program as a very strategic approach to expanding healthcare access to a population who is most likely to be uninsured, the working people who are unable to afford commercial healthcare. Senators, we ask your support of Senate File 726 that will provide funding for this demonstration project. The evaluation, I think, will also demonstrate whether this program has potential to go statewide, like the program in Oklahoma. At this time, I would like to call on two small business owners who are from the Duluth area who will speak to their experience and how the health share might impact them.
Mr. Chair, I currently have Lynn Gert, who is a small business owner from Northern Waters Smokehouse.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Like Senator Solon said, my name is Lynn Gert, and my husband and I own a business in the Canal Park area of Duluth called Northern Water Smokehouse. And we've been, it's a specialty food market that we've been operating in that location since 2001, so for 5 years. And we really represent the market for this product, and we play a vital role in the local economy in Duluth, just like small businesses do everywhere. And I just want to paint a picture quickly of our business and why there is the need for this product. And so, obviously, I'm here in support of Senate File 726. Our business is really considered successful in so many ways. We have a great reputation for our product. We are a retail business that pays significantly higher than the sector that we represent, at least twice minimum wage. We have retained the same employees for 4 years, which is also very, very rare. A lot of local new entrepreneurs come to our business and seek kind of mentorship and advice on how to start a small business. We just made our first profit, which I'm proud to say, which actually for a small business, as you know, most small businesses aren't successful. And in the food business, 5 years is about typical for to make a profit. And, you know, we are committed to retaining the employees. We're committed to providing quality products. We're committed to offering as much benefit and economic stability that we can. But we do not offer insurance. We have seven employees, and only three of the seven employees currently have health insurance. Of the four that do not have health insurance, the primary reason is inability to find an affordable option in the commercial market, ineligibility for Minnesota care, and not having a spouse from which somebody would be eligible for coverage. Of the three employees that do have insurance, one pays $500 for a catastrophic policy in the commercial market, no dental coverage, and two other employees are eligible for Minnesota care and pay in the $30-$40 range per month for Minnesota care. You know, and we are prime candidates for the health share product. That's why I've been committing my time as a business owner to help get this product started. We are committed to being an investor in the product. As an employer, we can afford up to $75 per month per employee, and our employees also are willing to pay. So we're very committed. We're highly supportive of the focus on prevention and the case management component of the product. And we're just, this is necessary for this whole viability of the economic sector that we represent in our community. So I'm very supportive, and I encourage you to consider passing this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gert.
Mm-hmm. And then, Mr. Chair, I have Diane Soden Groves.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you for hearing me. The business that I own is a music store in Duluth. It's called Great Northern Music Center. My husband and I have only owned this business for 2 years, so unlike my partner, we are not yet in the black, which also makes it a little more difficult to try to incorporate any other specific benefits for our employees that when we are still kind of struggling to work as a business. One of the things that we do do, though, is that our employees are paid quite well. Actually, my husband and I are the lowest paid employees in our business, and that is not uncommon in many small businesses. I am also representing the uninsured. I can't afford insurance. I probably don't look like what you might think of as the typical uninsured individual. I have a college degree. I work full-time. I have a variety of jobs, and I have spread myself quite thinly, but I cannot afford insurance. Unfortunately, my husband and I earn too much money to qualify for Minnesota care, and we can't afford the minimum premiums. If we were to both purchase a premium, we would, in either Minnesota care or Blue Cross and Blue Shield, even with a $3,000 deductible or a $3,000 catastrophic care, we would be making more than our house payment, and we can't afford to own two homes. We are the ones that have to choose. Do I make a house payment or do I buy insurance and hope that I never have a catastrophic event occur where I could possibly lose my home? So I am that picture of the uninsured, and I hope you can look at this and look at this this bill and realize how beneficial it could be for a variety of people. As business owners, I want to provide a lot for my employees, and I what the bill proposes as far as what payments would be is something I could afford as an individual and I could afford as a business person. The other part of it that is so positive about this program is the educational component, and we teach individuals to take responsibility for their own physical health, and that they are responsible in many ways to make the problem less than what it could have been. One of the things that uninsured people do is they don't go to the doctor soon enough. They go when it's too late, it's too expensive, and then it becomes catastrophic. So this educational component can get the people in before it becomes a catastrophic issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony.
And Mr. Chair, I have also Dan Svensson, also from Generations Healthcare Initiatives.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Good afternoon. As Lon said, my name is Dan Svensson. I have a long and varied career in healthcare finance and administration. I'm a CPA. I've been a hospital executive. I've been a consultant, and I've been working for the last 5 years with Generations to try to improve access to primary and mental health care in Duluth. And believe me, it's a struggle. There are a few things I'd like to add to my colleague's testimony today, things that I think are important to, statements about what we've done here in our community. Number one is what we're looking at here is a collaborative model. Typically, a community will look to the providers to solve access problems. But early on, we recognized that the problem of access to health care is not our local provider's problem. It's at least, it's at the very least, the community's problem. And as you well know, it's maybe not even a state problem, it's a national problem. But at least here in Duluth, we've put together a coalition of providers, government, business, and others to try to improve access to primary health care. The program that we're modeling ourselves on from Muskegon, Michigan, is a proven program. It's been in operation for 7 years. It's fiscally stable. A couple things Jenny didn't mention is that the community money that comes to the Muskegon program comes from the state of Michigan. And I also wanted to make comment. I believe Jenny said that the requirement was that you had to make $12.50 an hour to be qualified, and actually an employer with a median income of $12.50 an hour or less would qualify.
Thank you.
Okay, so, but what we see here is a community in Muskegon that's very similar in attributes to Duluth. So we believe that it's a proven product that we can implement there. There's definitely a need. A recent Duluth Chamber of Commerce survey showed that among its members, the cost of health care is their number one concern, and I don't think that'd be a surprise to any of you. 80% of the Chamber's members have fewer than 50 employees. In fact, probably over 50% of those members are typical of the folks who've talked to you today, anywhere from 3 to 10 employees. Our economy relies on small businesses to provide interesting things for tourists to interesting places for tourists to shop and things to do, and as well as to serve the people in our community. Our medium household income, however, is about $10,000 less than the state average, and as you heard from Lynn and Diane, traditional insurance models just aren't affordable. And so it's unfortunate. It's just unfortunate that we're in the state where we are in healthcare today. There's a will to do this in our community. Our employer and employee focus groups that we've conducted over the last year show that small employers are interested in helping their employees, and they can afford to pay somewhere between $50 and $100 a month. And similarly, the employees have indicated they want coverage, and they'll pay similar amounts. They just can't afford ordinary insurance premiums. What we're proposing is very good for the physical and financial health of our community. Given this population, it's generally younger, avoids going to seeking health care at all costs because of they're afraid of the bills that they'll face, and usually wind up getting into the health care system in catastrophic situations. By giving this population a medical home, we know that we will improve their health, get them preventative care, and hopefully prevent the very expensive acute episodes that wind up being a huge detriment to the entire healthcare system. It will also help our small employers in recruit and retain healthy, productive employees, making them more sustainable. And I think the final thing that I'd like to say today is that it's doable. And we know this program's not perfect. It's only a coverage program. So people in this program will have to go to the providers who are willing to provide the service. But it's something for a group that has nothing until they can get something better. We have a dedicated group of providers that are ready to go at risk to provide these services, and we have over half the funding we need. While there are many state and national initiatives being discussed, most are being planned. They're not ready to act. We're ready to act right now, and with your help in support of this bill, we can do it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we will stand for questions if there are any.
Okay. Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions, but does staff know or what is the maximum income to qualify for Minnesota Care?
Senator Vanderveer, Mr. Stang left the room. We can ask him when he comes back.
Okay. Well, right now. Mr. Stang.
Senator Vanderveer.
Do you know the maximum income to qualify for Minnesota Care?
I do not. That program is generally under the jurisdiction of the Health Committee as a state program, and I'm not sure.
What? Senator Pretner-Solon?
Maybe Ms. Peterson knows.
Okay, Ms. Peterson.
What I can tell you, it's based on family size, and at this point, a person who makes $12.50 an hour or $26,000 a year does not qualify for Minnesota Care if it's a single person or a couple.
And Senator, Mr. Chair,
Senator Pretner-Solon.
What often occurs, too, is that the premiums are really higher than lots of people can afford on their low incomes.
Senator Vanderveer.
And then with regard to the federal fund issue, do we know why was that in current law? It says in your legislation that you're deleting a part of the current statute that the commissioner shall only approve a program that has been awarded the community.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Pretner-Solon.
Senator Vanderveer, last year when we asked permission to create this program, there was the intent to request a federal grant at that time. And maybe Ms. Peterson can, or Mr. Svensson can tell us what has happened there.
Thank you. We were awarded a federal grant called the Healthy Communities Access Program, and that grant is no longer available. The grant funds recently ended. The grant assisted us in putting together a few initiatives, and that's why it's not in the bill this time, because it's not available.
Well, Senator Vanderveer?
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, do we want to eliminate this in current statute or just make an exception?
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Vanderveer, I was reading this as such that they should make sure that the program meets federal grant requirements in case there would be any federal grant requirements coming again. But I don't know. Maybe it is redundant language, useless language, if there isn't going to be any more federal grant money.
Apparently, Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, there's no other money available.
Mr. Stang.
And Mr. Chair, also, the Commissioner of Health has got to approve this program, and the language struck says that they can only approve a program that has been awarded a grant. So if they didn't get a grant, the Commissioner couldn't approve it, so it couldn't go forward. So I think that's why that's done.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Vanderveer and Senator Scogin were suggesting that next sentence could be beginning of the next sentence. The program meets federal grant requirements. You could probably delete that if there are no federal grant requirements to meet.
21 and 22.
Mr. Chair, we're certainly agreeable to that. That makes sense.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, then I think you'd want to strike lines 121 and line 122 up through and. So 121, the commissioner shall ensure that the program and then, I'm sorry, then meets the federal grant, delete meets the federal grant, and in the next line, delete everything up until through the word and.
Yeah.
Does that?
Keep the word meets, though. So, just drop the federal grant requirements and.
No, if you drop meets, since this program is actuarially sound.
Mr. Stang.
I believe that the amendment.
I'm sorry. I see.
That Senator Scheid proposes would, then the sentence would read, the commissioner shall ensure that the program is actuarially sound based on a review of appropriate records and methods utilized by the community-based health initiatives.
Section two.
Senator,
you know,
Marty.
Mr. Chair, I think you probably want to leave then just delete the federal grant requirements and I don't know what the requirements in the section are.
Even better. Right. Oh, you want
I think Senator Marty's correct. Yeah.
You got it.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Mr. Stang,
we'll try it again.
We're getting this.
We'll try it again. It's getting better, though.
We drag a lawyer into this.
I think we have.
The commissioner shall ensure that the program meets any requirements described in this section and is actuarially sound, and so on.
Senator Pretner Solon?
Mr. Chair, we have no problems with that.
Okay.
Amendment.
On the Marty amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Yeah, oral amendment is adopted. Senator Pretner Solon.
Mr. Chair, I then would, if you're ready for a motion, move that Senate File 726 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Okay. Senator Vanderveer?
I'm sorry, I did have one other question regarding the eligibility. It says in the handout on page 3 that a business is eligible if it has not offered health insurance benefits to its employees during the previous 12 months. Is that...
Senator Vanderveer, which hand, are you on the bill or the...
I'm on the handout.
Okay. Okay.
Page 3 of the handout.
Yep. No, thank you.
So what that would mean is if a company, even if it had the same situation, met all the other criteria with regard to wages and other benefits, just because it had somehow found a way to qualify, then it couldn't qualify for the subsidized health program.
You want to take that one?
Senator Pretner Solon or
Mr. Chair, I suspect that is to prevent companies dropping insurance to be eligible, but Mr. Svensson may want to elaborate.
Mr. Svensson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Manvier, our concern in structuring the bill this way was to prevent employers from dropping insurance in favor of providing a cheaper product and competing with the insurance companies, because what we're providing is a coverage program.
So follow up,
Senator Vanderveer.
So if conceivably we could be subsidizing the health care for a competitor, even if they had the same wages and everything else, that now that company couldn't qualify for. So one company would have subsidized health care doing the exact same thing as another company who couldn't qualify for state subsidized health care.
Mr. Chair, Senator Vanderveer.
Senator Pretner Solon.
However, they would both be under the same requirements that they hadn't had health insurance for a year. They would both have to meet that same requirement.
Thank you.
Which could, Senator Mr. Vanderveer. Chair, encourage them to drop their health care for a year, but.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator.
No, okay. It was.
Further discussion. Senator Pretner Solon renews her motion that Senate File 726 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Another bill right now?
Okay.
we talked about what we'll do tonight.
Yes, sure.
Okay. Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I apologize to members. It's that time of year, and it came a lot sooner than it does normally for most of us, presenting bills in different committees, but they were very gracious to me and let me go first in transportation. So, Senator Sparks, and I know you have a bill in another committee as well. Do you have somebody to alert you?
Yeah, we do. We're right across the hall, so hopefully. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to present Senate File
1168
to you today. This is a bill that's completed operations coverage as a component of the general policy that offers residential contractors, builders, and remodelers insurance coverage on a new house or remodeling project after the construction is finished. Most GL policies today don't include completed operations coverage, forcing builders to self-insure work up to 10 years. With me today, Madam Chair, to help explain the bill is Mrs. Pam Weaver, and I would turn over to her at this time.
Welcome. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Pam Perry Weaver. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Builders Association of Minnesota. I represent the residential construction industry in the state. We have approximately 5,000 members throughout the state of Minnesota. We build about 80% of the residential construction throughout the state. I really appreciate Senator Sparks and the committee listening to this bill and some of the issues the residential construction industry has faced with regards to insurance. In 1991, the Minnesota legislature required that builders be licensed, and we support that. You also required that we have general liability insurance. I have a PowerPoint presentation that I give to builders to explain what general liability insurance is, because sometimes it can be moving from construction to insurance gets complicated. I'd like to give you a copy of this PowerPoint. I won't be giving it. But essentially, general liability is supposed to cover three things. The basic definition of general liability insurance is property damage, bodily injury, and with respect to construction, completed operations. Completed operations coverage means that when a builder finishes the job, walks off the job site, sells that house, there remains, in effect, general liability insurance for damages to that property. What's happened in the marketplace in the last 5 or 6 years, as the number and the kind of construction litigation has increased, insurance companies have been shaving off significant parts of coverage. We have found, actually, we did an analysis of builders insurance in the Twin Cities market, and if you can, just bear with me. We did analysis of 667 builders' policies, insurance policies, in the Twin Cities, which is really has been the toughest place for builders to find insurance, builders who are building in the Twin Cities. Of those 660-some builders, there were 48 different insurance companies selling them insurance. Half of those were in the surplus lines market, and half of those, and this is a combination of both surplus lines and standard, were not covering completed operations. There was a completed operations exclusion in the policy. We believe that's a public policy flaw. We think that it was not the legislature's intent when you require general liability insurance of our industry that insurance end when a builder walks off the job site. I think that when you require general liability insurance of us in 1991, that it have completed operations coverage for both property damage and bodily injury. So what this bill seeks to do is to, on lines 1.8 through 1.10, it essentially just further defines what general liability insurance is and what builders should have in their policy. I think this is a consumer issue as well. I think that with the litigation at hand in our industry, homeowners are hoping that builders have complete insurance. And if this insurance type of insurance coverage starts to continue to disappear or continues to disappear, I think we're going to have a problem on our hands long term. So that's why we're proposing this language. I hope I certainly want to answer any questions about about the impacts on the marketplace and the bill itself.
Ms. Perry Weaver, I wondered, can you tell me what kind of a situation would be covered? What's the kind of thing that can happen when you say when the builder's done? I'm trying to imagine where are we now? We're waiting either to have the home sold or to have it closed.
Madam Chair, I'm talking about 5, 6, 7, 10 years after the home has been sold, and I'm specifically talking about water intrusion. Water intrusion is a problem in Minnesota. There's water everywhere. We can't get away from it. And water intrusion is a significant problem in our industry after the home has been sold. And so that general liability insurance policy helps cover some of the damages that are resulting from either faulty construction or subcontractors' faulty construction. And so that general liability policy serves as a source of revenue, so to speak, to help pay for those problems.
Ms. Perry Weaver, would it cover then the insured if there were something faulty done by the insured?
General liability insurance, generally, you know, there's a couple different ways that it covers an insured. If I'm a builder and I subcontract out all of my work, the general liability insurance policy will pay for my subcontractor's work. If I use a hammer, which I would never do myself. If I'm out on a job site myself, my general liability insurance policy as a standard excludes my work. However, it will pay for damages resulting from my work. So, for example, my work is to install a window. I installed it incorrectly, and water damage has resulted. My insurance policy will pay for the damages resulting from my work, so the wet wall, but it will not cover my work, which was putting the window in the wall. Do you understand the difference between those two things? So that's standard. It's standard in general liability insurance policies. So that's the issues that we're facing. So when an insurance company excludes completed operations, when we hand over our contract and we're done building that house, there is no more general liability insurance for that homeowner nor for that builder if completed operations is excluded.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When did they start doing this? I guess I missed that piece.
Ms. Perry Weaver.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, it started in about 2001. And really, when the number of water intrusion litigation started to increase on the West Coast, it kind of moved across the country. And there was a few really significant cases in California and Texas. And because Minnesota is part of a national – when we buy insurance, we're part of national insurance pools – those court cases really had an impact on the market. We had an insurance expert come in and talk to a group of agents about a year ago, and he basically walked through the case law starting in California in about 1999-2000 and documented how insurance services office, the ISO office, which writes exclusions and policies, started offering these types of exclusions for insurance companies to adopt. And some of them have. Standard markets have adopted these exclusions. E&S markets or surplus lines have adopted some of these exclusions. So it's across the board.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Perry Weaver, are you avoiding the M word?
The M word.
Is this really a mold issue?
Mold.
Ms. Perry Weaver.
Senator Scheid, Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, mold, water intrusion, I'm certainly not avoiding it. We're trying to address it. Water, you need water to create mold, so I think water is the initial problem.
Senator Johnson.
So, and Madam Chair, so does this mean that when they hand you, like, that little warranty thing at the end from 2001 forward, there's really no guts to it?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, a general liability insurance policy, you bring up an interesting question, and I hope I don't give you too much of an answer. The legislature required builders to warrant their homes for a 10-year period. We do not sell, some builders sell warranty policies that cover our warranty obligations. That's different than a general liability insurance policy. We tell builders, and you'll see in my PowerPoint presentation, it's a bad idea to use general liability insurance as a warranty policy because sometimes it may cover some of those items, but it may not. Warranty, you required us to warrant the product, but you never required us to offer a warranty insurance product. You required us to offer a general liability insurance product.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Senator Sparks?
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of one of those buyer beware type of bills. We want to protect the consumer.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I would say that's exactly what it is.
Oh.
Senator Sparks, you're saying that, I'm not sure I understood the question.
Consumer.
Senator Johnson, can you repeat?
Madam Chair, it seems to me that a good builder would carry both general liability and warranty insurance.
Certainly.
I didn't realize that there was a difference.
Okay. Now I understand what your question was.
Senator Scheid, Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, there is a significant difference. Which is why, again, in the PowerPoint presentation, you'll see if a builder uses their general liability insurance to pay for their warranty obligations, it will cause nothing but heartache and pain.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Ms. Weaver, or Senator Sparks, question, if a builder builds my home and then remains in business for a few years and then goes out of business, they, I presume, no longer are a licensee, no longer have to maintain the insurance. At that point, supposing they built my house 5 years ago and they go out of business, do I lose out? They no longer maintain the insurance. Is the insurance pay off then anyway, or do they, or what happens?
Ms. Perry Weaver.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, the legislature, in its infinite wisdom, passed a bill last year that would require the builder to maintain, they still have a general liability and warranty obligation after they dissolve their corporation. That was passed in the Notice and Opportunity Repair Bill that Senator Scheid authored last year. We added there was an additional line in there.
Was that Senator Anderson's provision?
Yes,
Senator
it was.
Ellen Anderson's provision.
Yes, Madam Chair, it was called the Camacho, it addressed the Minnesota Supreme Court case called Camacho, and it was Senator Anderson's addition to the bill.
Because I think we had builders who went out of business but then took up business again under a different company name, if I'm not mistaken, that was part of that.
Madam Chair, that's exactly correct. When the Minnesota Supreme Court made that decision on the Camacho case, they essentially let all general liability insurers off the hook for paying anything if a builder dissolves his corporation. And the builder has inventory of 10 years after they sell that house. They've got an inventory of 10 years. They've got an obligation for 10 years. And that general liability insurance policy should be an asset to whether that builder is in business or not. So that's why the Builders Association supported that provision. And Senator Marty, it addresses your question specifically.
Senator Vandeveer.
Well, Madam Chair, I think what actually happened is we made them liable whether they went out of business or not. But the insurance, if the insurance isn't an occurrence-based policy, I don't believe claims made insurance that you have a policy is if you're not paying the premium. And I think we had considerable debate about that in the House and what. So, yes, they are liable, but whether the insurance company still has insurance on that property or not, I think, is debatable.
Ms. Perry Weaver, do you?
Madam Chair, Senator Vandeveer, you're right. I think some of the frustration that we had about the titles of an occurrence-based policy versus a claims-made policy, there are many standard markets that are selling an occurrence-based policy but have put on prior works exclusions, which means they've turned their occurrence-based policy into a claims-made policy. When you throw a prior works exclusion on and says, boy, I'm not going to cover any of your previous inventory, you've just turned that occurrence-based policy into a into a claims-made policy. So they've lopped off all of a builder's previous inventory. So the semantics and what I have learned, I am not an insurance expert, but what I've learned in this business is the semantics that the insurance companies have used to reduce their obligation to pay has been significant. Prior works exclusions, completed operations exclusions, water intrusion exclusions, redefining what water is, mold. It's really been pretty significant. And the purpose of this bill is so a builder has insurance after he sells that home for a period of time. I mean, actually, it doesn't say a period of time in the bill. Essentially, it's about 10 years.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, on that point, this committee, this legislature regulates insurance. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that if the goal is to make sure that they have to pay these claims, it would cost more, the policy would cost more. But if the goal is to make sure they have these claims paid, it seems to me that we ought to require that they take care of it that way.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, we've made a number of complaints to the Department of Commerce on the Fair Claims Practices Act for insurance companies not properly coming to the table. In addition, we participated in amicus briefs at the Supreme Court requiring insurance companies to come to the table. So we're approaching that issue from both the court system and the regulatory side of things. We think that some insurance companies have not done their due diligence, and we've made formal complaints to the department about that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Marty.
Ms. Perry Weaver, I think that that sounds good that you're doing it regulatorily and through the courts. Is there a reason not to do it legislatively?
Ms. Perry Weaver.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, one bite at a time, I guess. I think if I added, you know, a direct action and, you know, some of those types of issues into this, I don't know if it would be well received. One piece at a time, I think, is how we approach this. But I sure would be interested in discussing that as a next step.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I think that might be wise to discuss as a next step. I'll take your word on this. I have one other question. This is kind of wording one, maybe for Senate Counsel or maybe the author, but I know we have a Commissioner of Education, a Commissioner of Health, and this Commissioner of Cancellation instructor.
You haven't met him, Senator Marty.
And I was kind of wondering if maybe we wanted to change it to line 16, written notice of cancellation to the Commissioner instead of the Commissioner of Cancellation.
Senator Marty, I had read the same thing. I thought. I think that's probably in order. So I think you could actually do it just by not saying of cancellation because it's – but I can you read what you have? Because I think we'll take your ideas. On 116.
116 after a written notice, insert of cancellation and then
after
delete
notice,
of cancellation. Yeah.
Cancellation, sure.
On line 116,
yeah.
After the word notice, in insert of cancellation.
And then delete.
And on 117 – delete of cancellation.
Sure.
Well, I actually kind of did like this.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to be appointed to the commissioner as the commissioner of cancellation if that's what you're interested in. I would like to cancel a lot of things, actually.
So it reads written notice of cancellation to the commissioner because that we know this is within the commissioner of commerce. But any discussion on that amendment? Sorry, fell asleep at the wheel here. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Thank you, Senator Marty. And is there other discussion? I did want to ask Ms. Perry Weaver how you feel about you. Well, I suppose if there's somebody in the audience that maybe could speak to it as well, what this would have to do with how this would affect availability.
Madam Chair, as I had said, we did an analysis of the markets. We have 48 markets. Half of them are surplus lines. Half of them are standard. I've talked to a couple of these companies asking how they feel. Some are delighted because it will increase their market share. Because if you look at my 48 markets, it's they're all over the map. So I think we're going to be okay. Minnesota is a good state to do business in, and I think it's going to be okay. If it isn't, I'll come back to you.
And I know that you do a good job in your association of keeping builders, you know, having builders do the best they can and to comply with not only with licensing and regulation, but to have high standards, and I appreciate that.
Thank you. Well,
we're well served.
Thank you, Senator. We view this as a consumer protection bill, and the industry is willing to pay more for our insurance if it means that the consumers will be protected long term, because it's about our reputation.
And that was another observation that I had silently. I'm sure there'll be a price to pay for it, but if the industry is asking for it. Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to speak to this?
Mr. Brenner's coming
Brunner.
Forward.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Brunner. I'm the president of the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association. And the bill does essentially capture manufactured home installers in terms of having to meet these insurance requirements. And we think this is a good thing. In checking with a couple of the major suppliers of insurance to the industry, the amounts that are being required here are reasonable, and anyone that carries a minimum amount of insurance would at least meet this threshold. So we're supportive of the senator's bill. Thank you.
Mr. Brunner, thank you. Is there anybody else who would like to come forward for or against the bill? Seeing none. Senator Sparks, then.
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 1168, as amended, be recommended to pass, and I believe this can go to the floor.
I believe that's right. On Senator Sparks' motion that Senate File 1168, be as amended, be recommended to pass and go to the floor, all those in any discussion by members? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much. Thank you. And Senator Sparks, did you want to? Were you planning to take your bills now, or did you announce? I'm sorry, Senator Marty.
Just
people, we love it when school gets out early or committee meetings. Ever, I understand. Nobody wants some spare time more today than I do. But did
I believe
you?
Tangie was going to check in the hall quickly. My understanding is that
we know that.
Senate File 761 needs to wait till this evening because some of the opposition folks
are
here.
The witnesses, right, and it's people who are opposed
and
to the bill.
And Senate File 832.
I think they're tied up in the House as we speak. So,
if Tangie can find 744, we could possibly take that up.
Okay. So Senator Johnson and Senator Sparks have, I believe, they're the same bill, identical bills, and we'll be taking that up. And Senator Johnson, I trust that you'll help present as well, right?
Okay.
And so we will do these. We'll just wait for Ms. Harrison to
was that a good one?
Report back to us, unless she escaped. She saw Senator Marty stand up and she fled.
Yes.
What are we done for the
afternoon? Just a minute. We're waiting. The word here. So
rental thing.
You got a sports car with a 20.
So there's no. They're not here. So with the members, I'll see you again at 6 o'clock. With that, the meeting's adjourned. Thank you.